Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In hold on here. In today's segment, we'll be talking with Mr. Joseph Caruso, the Chief Technology Officer and founder of Global Digital Forensics. They are a leading provider of cyber incident response and security services in New York City. Joe, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah. We looked up your bio. You know, we didn't do like a background check or anything, but we looked up your bio on LinkedIn, did some Google searching, looked at your website, some detail, and you seem to have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career, please, and like what brought you to the business here? I mean, you have such a varied experience skill set.
So, yeah, it's pretty interesting the way I started. Back in the 80s, I was working for Bell Labs, and during that time period, we had a request from a federal agency to assist them with looking at a payroll system out in the Midwest for a very large company, and they didn't have the know-how internally to do an audit. So at the time, I was scheduled to be in the Midwest, and they sent me over to work with the IRS and wound up doing this audit. And it was really very early, one of the earliest computer forensic exams. I mean, the system itself was still running on tape, you know, yellow tape. And it was pretty interesting. And then after that, more and more business started to come around from different aspects, predominantly government work. And it just grew from there.
Wow. Is there any more highlights your career like you elaborate about? I mean, you've got such a astounding history. We'd love to hear more about it. It's very motivating, very inspiring. I'd like to have our audience hear more about that.
Yeah, sure. So I then started to do some training for the Department of Defense, trained at the Digital Warfare School in Fort Lewis in Washington State, did training all over the country, probably trained in excess of 1,000 cybersecurity and forensic people over the years.
Wow.
Doing these training sessions. And they included everyone from private companies, that sent their people to, you know, CIA and even NSA folks that have sat through the classes. So I offered those classes for a long time and started doing the work. And as that progressed, I was asked to sit on a cybersecurity panel. This was after 9/11. Cybersecurity started to come into the highlights. So I sat on a couple of roundtables with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and two presidents. It was pretty exciting there. And then got to do work with a bunch of infrastructure companies and groups like the American Water Works Association and NERC, so different power and energy and infrastructure providers. And that's where I am today. You know, I'm running a company that has 16 offices in the United States and another 16 overseas, you know, all over the world. And we do cybersecurity testing and incident response and architecting. And we really focus on infrastructure. So we do assessments for power plants. We do assessments for water supplies. And that's where I am.
Okay, cool. So how do you exactly venture into Global Digital Forensics? Is this a company that you started on your own and kind of grew on your own, or did you have, like, partners with you? Or?
It is. So originally I had a software company that wrote all different types of software, but predominantly worked on real-time systems and terrain tracking radar, did some contracts for E-Systems and the Tomahawk missile project. But because of that knowledge, the math that went with it and the ability to work with embedded systems and to start from scratch, I continued to do the forensics, and I had a partner who ran the software company with me. We sold the software company and then once that software company was sold, I figured, what am I going to do at this point? So I started up Global Digital Forensics, and the company started small, but because of the training and because of the different things that we did around the country, started to bring in work, and it just grew. So it was really, I did have a partner in the beginning, and then it just grew into my own operation.
Oh, that's excellent. Congratulations. Sounds awesome.
Okay.
Now, how long have you been in business?
Global Digital Forensics, we actually had a name change. It was originally Business Intelligence Associates, and it didn't really fit what was going on. So some of the guys continued Business Intelligence. They do like e-discovery and legal work. But I formed Global Digital Forensics as it is today, 1991.
Okay. Now, so, you talked about the your presence in other countries. Can you elaborate on that in a little bit more detail?
Sure. So we have 16 offices. We have three offices in New York, one in Times Square at 1500 Broadway, and then we have two additional offices in White Plains, New York, which is a lab, and Oceanside, New York, which is a lab. And then we have offices in Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Miami, Tampa. Gosh, I can't even remember all the cities anymore. Washington D.C. So we're we're fairly geographically dispersed around the country, and all those offices have staff that are qualified to do cybersecurity and forensics.
Okay, I'm actually based out of Chicago. Where is your office in Chicago?
The office in Chicago is on Wabash.
Okay.
So it's,
gotcha.
It's downtown. It's in the loop. So it is absolutely down there, and we have two guys that work out of that office full time.
Excellent. Okay. Sounds awesome. Now let's get to your customer base. Who is it that you're trying to target? Is it the small and medium sized businesses, the mom and pop stores? Or is it the larger companies like Fortune 500, or maybe a mixture of both of these?
Yeah, you know, we have two lines of business. We have the computer forensics business, which is investigating incident, computer incidents, or working with attorneys. It's post-mortem analysis of events that happened on computers, networks. And that is predominantly our biggest market there. Is really mid-sized businesses. You know, I want to say anywhere from 50 to 500 or so employees. We do very well in that space. It's a sweet spot for us, and we like working with companies that, you know, the problem with Fortune 500 companies is they're very bureaucratic and between paperwork and getting things done. We're usually days before we get on site. With smaller companies, we have a much better working relationship and a long-term relationship. So in that space, we're really, mid-sized businesses. We do work for Fortune 500 companies all the time in the incident response, but that's usually because we have a very specialized skill set. Outside of just Windows and Linux, we do have people who are familiar with, real-time systems, Stratus hosts, mainframes, a lot of areas that there's just not a lot of forensic people practicing right now. And then our other line of business is security consulting, cybersecurity consulting, where we do pen testing and security architecting. And we have a very diverse client base there, anywhere from, small investment firms that are money managers. They may have a few billion dollars under management. And they could be, two or three guys in an office in Connecticut or Massachusetts, to companies that have, that are very large power and energy companies, water and sewer companies that we do consulting for, a lot of logistics companies, because we do have a deep knowledge of SCADA and embedded systems. We tend to do a lot of pretty cool engagements. You know, we've tested the automated train system. We've tested things for the FAA, the air traffic control systems. We've tested, the power grid for different companies attempting to hack in and developing security methods to protect them. The advanced meter infrastructure, which are, you know, these meters that are on your home that send information back on usage. So we've tested a very broad array of things, not just networks, but all types of devices and all types of systems that are coming into place. And it's pretty exciting. It's really cool to get a job where, you have to test something that no one's ever tested before, and you start from scratch, from the blueprint all the way up to writing what you believe are best practices for that particular infrastructure, that particular device.
Well, it sounds like you got a good breadth of the customer base profiles here. It's excellent. Now, let's get into your product and service line. You just touched on that in the last question. You talked about network forensics, incident response, pen testing, SCADA security, and cybersecurity consulting. Could you elaborate on these in more detail? And when you hit on the SCADA security subject, can you explain what SCADA is for audience? Because I don't think everyone really knows what that's all about.
Sure. Not a problem at all. So I guess we'll start with incident response. So when we do incident response, what we're really doing is responding to a data breach. Somebody gets hacked either by penetrating the network perimeter, internal threat, phishing. So we would respond to and assist companies in determining the root cause of the hack, determining if it's a reportable event. Was data really touched? Do we need to report this to a regulatory agency? Do we need to send out letters to clients? What's our response going to be to help them clean up the network to make sure that that the network is clean and they're not still losing data if they didn't lose any originally? And then finally, to come up with a recovery strategy. How are we going to recover from this event, both technically, which is part of the cleanup and remediation, and in the media and from a legal perspective? You know, what do we need to tell our clients? And that's really the incident response portion of it. We do what we call base forensics. That is, people come to us, there's lawsuits that are filed, and they're predominantly e-discovery where, someone has to provide documents. But there are times when law firms come to us and say, we have a feeling that the other side is trying to hide something, or we need to get data off of a device like an iPad or an iPhone, or we need to look at what this person did in the course of their employment. We have their computer records. So that's really computer forensics. The incident response is more network forensics. And then SCADA is really an acronym for supervisory control and data acquisition. It's the method of, or it's the infrastructure where you have PLCs, devices that are, let's say, valves or controllers, switches in a train system. Those are devices that are part of industrial control networks predominantly. And what they do is they take data and they send them to something that either that aggregates that data in some cases. In other cases, they are used to control things. So, for example, the automated train system would control switches and track allocations and actually locomotives themselves, how fast they're going, how slow they're going. So all of these things are really fall into the SCADA, the SCADA realm. And that's why we call it supervisory control and data acquisition, because they are devices that are designed to do many different things. So a good example of what we would do is, in the power and energy space, let's say a company needs to test their grid. So they have different controllers, like programmable logic controllers, PLCs, that say would monitor or control turbines in a generation plant. And they're sending data back to what we would call a historian or a computer that gathers this information, and they do analytics on it, and they check usage over time and generation over time, failure predictions. But they also can send information to those controllers that say, shut down this turbine or speed up this turbine, things like that. So we would go in, just like they would do a pen test on a network, we attempt to penetrate the SCADA network. And we do that from the outside to get through, say, they use a new term called virtual air gap, where there's no internet access, but they do have VPN tunnels in and different things like that. So we'll try to penetrate that way. We'll actually drive out to locations like a generating plant or transfer station and see if we can connect to their radios and get into the radios, if someone will let us in. So we do a full, what we would call like a red team effort on the infrastructure to see if we can penetrate it. And then we write a report, or we'll go in and we'll look at the infrastructure that they currently have, and we will design a set of policies and procedures that they implement that follow best practices so that they keep their infrastructure secure. And we do that for a lot of different industrial control type networks and SCADA type networks. As I said, railroads, airports, train systems, sewer, water, anything that utilizes that, manufacturing plants, refineries, they all have these type of networks running. And they've been a weak link really in our cybersecurity for many years because they were originally air gapped, and now as these things expand and they do get internet access and they go to cloud based systems, we're starting to see these networks being exposed to the outside world, and they become, of course, a target.
Okay. Now, are these services available on cloud, or are they made on premises, or a combination of both?
Well, initially SCADA networks were, traditionally the best practices always said that SCADA networks themselves should be air gapped, right? There was no connection to the outside internet and no connection to the outside world. But of course, that had to change. As we saw power companies expanding and the power grid expanding, as we see manufacturing facilities that want to implement, artificial intelligence, for example, they might want to leverage, let's say, IBM's Watson, right? So they're going to send data from all types of things, robots and production line controllers and spray booths and whatever else they use in their manufacturing. Same thing with water companies. They are they're providing water to a million customers. They're gathering all that data, and they want to do things like predictive failure analysis. A lot of that can't be done on site or at a certain location. So now they have to get data back to a central office or a central processing plant, or in some cases up to the cloud. And it's becoming more of an IoT, an Internet of Things, than it is really true SCADA. We're starting to see cloud-based historians, for example, which are devices or were traditionally computers that gathered all of this PLC information. Now they're going to the cloud. We're starting to see people connecting to, Amazon, AWS to do heavy computing or to gather data. And then they're using different things like Elastic Cloud to process things. So we're starting to see that a very hybrid type of infrastructure. So it is constantly evolving, just like the Internet of Things is evolving.
Okay. Now, do you have a process for delivering these services? Do you have a methodology, or it just kind of varies depending on what the needs of the client are?
So, it really depends on, we have a standard. We base our testing as much as we can on NIST standards. So NIST has a set of standards, different cybersecurity standards for different infrastructures. So we do follow NIST guidelines in testing and things like that. The same thing with things like the SANS Institute has some guidelines. But really when it comes to delivering for a client, we have a general report template to report things to them so that all our reports kind of follow the same thing. But from a methodology standpoint, it really is initial testing. We need to get to know the client. We need to know what kind of infrastructure they have, what type of devices, what type of access. That way we can design a test that really gives them deep insight into what their vulnerabilities would be. So, for example, if a company has radio-based PLCs, a lot of times you'll have point-to-point radios or you'll have cellular connections that are connecting these different sites together. We need to know that so that we can test not only from the internet and internally, but we're going to want to test the radios to make sure that the radios are encrypting properly. If they have Zigbee networks, we want to check that their configurations are secure and proper. So it really varies from client to client. You know, we design a test based on the client's infrastructure, the client's needs, and what they're really what their expectation is. They expect us to attack them the way a nation state would attack them, for example. And in order to do that, we do a lot of reconnaissance.
Okay. Sounds excellent. Now, have you done any work on mobile security? I mean, as we know, you know, smartphones are kind of like becoming an extension of our personal and professional lives. It's like if we lose our smartphone or get stolen, we just feel paralyzed. Have you done any security work, like forensics, anything with that? Have you ever, like, jailbroken any Android or iOS devices in that regard? Or?
Sure. We've gone even beyond that. And actually, we have clients that utilize private APNs, right? So what that basically means is when your device connects to the cellular network, you have an access point name. So for T-Mobile, it might be, APN1.tmobile.whatever. And you can get a private APN that only your devices can connect to that access point. And the idea is that you now have a connection to the cellular network that nobody else can see or spy on or intercept. And we've gone to the point where we've attacked the modems themselves, the cellular hotspots, and captured the data transmission between the hotspots, something like a Stingray device almost, right? Same thing with, and that happens, without even doing any type of work on the device. And we've also, we continuously are investigating and testing different devices. Every time Android builds come out, we test them. Any Apple builds that come out, OS X, we test them to see what the vulnerabilities are, what we have to be aware of, what we have to warn our clients about. As far as jailbreaking, we jailbreak things all the time. It really helps us to test devices, to test apps also, because you not only have the base operating system, but you have the access to these millions of apps that are out there that will run on your Android device or on your Apple device. And in order to properly test those, many times we would have to jailbreak. We can test the app in a test environment. We can look at what it's doing, but really to get access to what we want to see in OS X, we jailbreak the devices all the time. So absolutely do a lot of mobile device research and and make sure that we understand what's out there and what the potential vulnerabilities are.
Okay. Is it true that Apple, that the iOS is a much safer platform than like the Android or Windows platforms?
Well, the only reason that I would say yes is not that they're not hackable, because really everything is hackable. But when we talk about the platform, we talk about two things, right? We talk about the ability for apps to get on a phone and compromise that phone, or for someone to connect to the phone. So we know that there was a Wi-Fi issue with Apple devices that allowed you to gain access to Apple phones through the Wi-Fi. Of course, they patched it, but it was certainly a vulnerability that was released on these phones. So from that perspective, I think Apple does a very good job of protecting the phone from compromise. They are absolutely compromisable. I mean, we jailbreak them, right? So that tells you that there's vulnerabilities in these phones. So if you lose a phone, you should be aware that while it's very difficult to bypass the passcode or the PIN, there are ways to do that. I mean, there's a device out there called the Gray Key that you know claims to bypass the passcode. There's also software that you can buy to bypass the passcode, and it depends on how strong it is. And it's really, when you ask me that, you know, to me, the security of the device itself and whether you lose it has a lot to do with the user, as almost all security does, right? The user has to set up strong passwords. They have to set up passwords that they don't use all over the place. They have to set up complex passcodes and passwords. They have to be careful with the device. They have to be careful about what they install on the device, who they give access to. So it's a very complicated question. I mean, I think that I can have an Android device that I configure that's much more secure than an Apple device that, say, my mom configured. So very complicated question. I think that Apple does a very good job on security. But Android, you know, if it's configured right and handled right, does a good job also. The big difference is that you cannot download apps from any app store on the Apple device. You have to go through Apple. On Android, you can basically download apps from anywhere, and that's the biggest problem.
Right. Yeah, I've written a few blogs. I think last year and me earlier this year about like, the apps that are downloaded that they have malware in them actually, and that Apple does a much better job scrutinizing the mobile apps from the developers before they're uploaded, I think, on iTunes, whereas Google really doesn't do as much scrutinization. So.
Yeah, no, that's
true. Anyway, okay. No, go ahead.
No, I mean, I agree with you. That's absolutely true.
Okay. Now, penetration testing, obviously, that's a very important thing in cybersecurity. In fact, one of my chapters in this book I'm writing on web app security is going to have a devoted chapter just to pen testing. Can you tell our audience really what pen testing is, how it works, and what are the red team exercises? Do you just do red team, or do you do blue team as well as purple team exercises?
Oh, we do all exercises. We do red team, we do blue team, we do a combination purple team, if you will. So it depends on what the client wants. But I just like to rewind a second on something you said, and I do agree that pen testing is very important. But I think it's really part of the overall security practice. So if we look at what makes a network secure, we can pen test and find out that you have, you know, that we can't penetrate your network. And that's great. But before we do a pen test, we always talk to clients about what their security posture is at the moment. Have they done a vulnerability assessment? Do they know if there's any low-hanging fruit So we always suggest a vulnerability assessment prior to a pen test so that we can look at the network and we can look at what's facing out there. Because the last thing in a pen test you want to do is to go to a client and say, okay, we penetrated your network because, you know, you had this old server sitting out there and we exploited it and we got in. And that's great. But really, that's something that should have been found during the vulnerability assessment. To say, let's look at our perimeter, let's look internally, let's see where the vulnerability scanners are going to find things. So really, it's a lightweight assessment so that we can find and remediate the low-hanging fruit. The other thing that I think that's important, the other thing in a pen test, depending on whether we're red teaming, is I think that it's a good idea to develop and implement the training portion of it and really drive that home before a pen test occurs. Because, you know, I've seen so many pen tests that, well, we do a really good job. Clients come to us, you know, 6 weeks later and say, well, we had an incident. We said, okay, let's look at this. And we find out that it's something that they told us not to test in the rules of engagement. You know, when you sit down with clients and you build out these rules of engagement, you really have to be aware that they're very wary of us testing mission critical systems. They're very wary of us testing mission critical applications. So, well, I do agree pen testing is a very, very important part of overall security. There has to be other things that happen with the pen testing as well. Regular vulnerability assessments, internal vulnerability assessments, continuous user training. These are the kind of things that just supplement your overall security. The pen test helps you see how hackers see your network to an extent. Every pen tester and every pen testing team has different approaches to pen testing, and they go about it a different way. So it's really important that we understand that pen testing is just one brick in the wall, right?
Now, have you done any work with physical access security, like physical access entry?
Sure. I mean, on a red teaming efforts, we do it all the time. We will we'll do a bunch of things. I mean, we've gone and made, you know, ID cards and gone into places and told, you know, we went in one time and said we were from a local printer company. You know, we sat outside an organization's offices and we saw the companies that service them and deliver things to them. And we made up ID cards and said, hey, I'm a new salesman. I work for ABC Supplies. You know, we supply your printers. We have a new discount program where you can get points, but you have to use our software to order the supplies you need. And we've gone in and installed software on computers. And they let us install the software on 50 computers. And what the software was designed to do was really to log their keystrokes and send those keystrokes back to us. We've tailgated into places. Tailgating is basically, you know, you walk out, you go to the smoking area, let's say, and you hang out with people and talk to them and say, oh yeah, I'm here to do this, I'm here to do that. And when they walk back in the building, they use their access card and you just follow them in. We've gone as far as gone to bar, you know, watch where people go on happy hour and gone out to happy hour with them and snagged their IDs while they were having a drink and playing pool. So I believe that physical access is really, really an important part of testing also. Just, you know, as I said, you know, of all the responses we do, and we do hundreds and hundreds a year, I would say that 90% or more breaches are caused by user actions, and that's either, you know, they get phished through an email or spear phishing attack or physical access. I mean, we, you know, physical access is really, really important. How you control your assets is important, and how you control access to your physical network is important.
Okay. Now, in that regard, have you done any work with biometric technology? Because I know, like, fingerprint readers and hand readers, they can be used very well to help, you know, secure doors, you know, at both the primary means of entry as well as, as well as offices inside a building, too. Have you done any work in that regard, or?
Not as far as you know, installing biometric systems. We've done some testing on biometric readers from a security perspective. Can you bypass them? But, I think the higher-end ones have gotten very good. You know, I'm not an access control expert, but I do know that the biometric fingerprint readers we use in our offices, you know, we use the old three-step thing, who you are, what you know, and what is it? What you are, what you know, and something else, so that you have to actually you have to put in your passcode and do a fingerprint and to get in. So there's no just fingerprint in, fingerprint out. Oh, and what you have. So you have a card, you walk up, you touch your HID card to the device, you put your fingerprint on it, and then it goes green, and you put your passcode in, and you get in the door. But that's super high security. I think that securing with biometrics, yeah, I think it's probably a great idea. I mean, I'm a member of Clear. I'm sure you're familiar with that, right? You go to the airport, you basically put your fingers on a pad, and you don't need ID. But other than that, I'm not an expert in physical access control by any means.
Okay. Now, you alluded to it, I think, just a few minutes ago. Phishing is a hot topic. Now, as we know, that's like one of the oldest forms of a cyber attack, but there are many new variants of that coming out, you know, like business email compromise, ransomware. Can we discuss more about that? What work you've done it, and how have you helped, you know, businesses and corporations deal with phishing? It's still, a very prevalent threat out there.
Absolutely. So I think we should really define phishing and spear phishing, right? Phishing is really a mass attack, right? We put together an email and we send it out to everybody and anybody and hope that they respond to us. And that could be, you know, people in companies, it could be your grandmother. Spear phishing is really a targeted attack on individuals in an organization. Now, I think both are really serious threats because we may sit and say, well, I'll never respond to I am President Bapawabi of, whatever country, and my boss died and left $15 million and I need to get it out of the country type of things. So those are certain types where you'll get an email that says, you know, your Office 365 mailbox is almost full. Log in here to expand your storage. We're hoping that we train people enough that they learn not to respond to those things or trust those things. Spear phishing is a whole other level of attack. In our practice, we do spear phishing attacks against our clients all the time. And I've seen spear phishing attacks that are amazing. I actually saw at a very large bank, international bank, an email came in to five people within the bank that purported to be from a research organization, and it was titled, the future economic outlook of China based on current trading trends, something like that, right? And it was about a 200-page PDF that was so well written and so informative that the people who received it forwarded it to other people in the organization. In the meantime, it contained an exploit, and they were exploiting machines as they went and transferred this. So the five people spread it to about 100 people within the organization. And the phishing attack was so, this wasn't misspelled words or asking to send money. It was simply a PDF attachment that said something like, please find our latest report on Chinese economic trends and a very well-written report, and all five users opened it. So when it comes to highly targeted attacks by well-funded and well-educated organizations, whether it's state-sponsored actors or, for-hire hackers that are doing, corporate espionage, whatever it happens to be, we have to be aware that phishing is not just, asking your grandmother for money, right? That some of them are very well-crafted and well-executed. And that's what we do for our clients. If you want to just send an email that says, respond to me, I'm the president of Botswana, organizations can do that themselves. There's plenty of software out there, and I think it's a valuable thing. They should be doing that. But you should also get your users to understand that there are much more complicated phishing attacks, things that they may not have even realized that they've done. And that's basically what we do. So we attack our clients, and we train, and we help them build training that is appropriate for their level of the data. So if they're an organization that has secret or top secret information, they have a different standard than, say, an organization where most of their information is public. But the problem is you can still be held ransom. There's still ransomware, and there's still other ways that these attacks can cause irreparable damage to your organization. So you have to be aware of them, and that's what we do. We do these very highly specialized spear phishing attacks. And we've worked with clients. I mean, I've had clients, big companies that have spent, multi-million dollars making movies that they show their employees. I mean, they're about an hour long, some of them even longer. And it talks about, securing your laptop at a trade show or securing your laptop when you're traveling. It talks about, creating strong passwords. And then it talks about phishing and spear phishing and how to be wary of all of these different attacks that are coming at you. So to me, that overall, the weakest link in the chain is truly our users. And that's why spear phishing and phishing attacks are so successful. You have 100 users. I mean, who knows? You might train everybody really well, and you got 5 people on vacation, so you have to bring in a temp or two, and you set up a temp or two on computers, and they get email, or a student, a summer intern comes in, and they are far less trained and far less feel far less responsible for the organization. They probably click on everything. So I think we have to be aware of all these aspects of those kind of social engineering attacks.
Right. Okay, excellent. Now, the Internet of Things is becoming a very hot topic these days. It's one of the big buzzwords in cybersecurity, probably ever, AI. This is where everything's all connected together. Personally, I find this to be a very scary issue because I just can't imagine everything being connected. That just increases the attack surface for the cyber attacker. What are your thoughts on that, and what are the problems that we currently have on that? And do you think IoT and SCADA will ever be secure in that regard?
So, so I'm very worried, honestly. I think that we have a lot of problems with in the IoT world, and that's not just big SCADA operations, right? It's all the way down to our homes. So, I mean, you can read a ton about these. It originally started with these internet-connected cameras, right? I remember reading an article. There's a great blog out there, Krebs on Security, and he wrote about different what he called web polluters and how they write and release software that is just inherently not secure. And that's something that cameras had a big problem on. Many cameras released, these internet-connected cameras released software embedded on the cameras that had no password requirements or even no password. People were opening up ports in their routers and letting people into their home networks regularly because they had these baby monitors or security cameras, things that they want to do. And of course, you know, as human beings, we go online and we see a security camera that's $200, and then we see a security camera that's, you know, $49, and we're like, well, I'm going to buy the $49 one. And we follow the instructions and we set up an opening, and now we're letting people into our network that, that can do us harm. And this really trickles up to the corporate network. And that's why nomadic users that, that take laptops home and work from home really need to be controlled, because these things are opening up a lot of scary, a lot of scary things. I mean, personally, in my home, I have three networks, right? And they are three physical networks. I have a network that I connect my computer to and my work computer. I have a network that is a guest network that someone comes and visits, they get on the guest network. And then I have an IoT network because my refrigerator talks to the cloud. My TV talks to the cloud. Whatever the, you know, to me, the cloud is just really, has always been around. It's just, they talk to a server hosted somewhere. And, you know, I don't know what kind of security Samsung built into my refrigerator, or what type of security Sony built into my TV, or these little network cameras that I have, and these little devices to turn off my water and turn off my lights that are all internet connected. I mean, they're from so many different vendors and so many different companies that I really don't know. You know, I am certain that if I started testing the stuff around my house, that I would have a huge amount of vulnerabilities. So I am completely on board that, that something has to change in the world of IoT, and it has to change quickly, because these things are just, you know, they're just completely, you know, they're on our networks, they're everywhere, and we don't have any idea how secure they are. And I go into corporate clients, and I see people installing, like, you know, they have network-connected lights. I went into a client, the CFO of a very big company, and we walked in, and he said, you know, we got into his office, and he said, hey, Google, turn on the lights. And Google turned on the lights, and he had Google connected to these little $10 Wi-Fi plugs that turned on his lamps. And I said, well, what are you connecting those to? I said, what are you connecting those to? And he said, I'm connecting them to the Wi-Fi network, the guest network. No, no, to the corporate network. The guest network's unreliable. So there you go.
Right.
So
wow.
I am very afraid of what we're getting into with IoT.
Right. I can guarantee you probably your vendors who made your refrigerant key probably didn't do too much security in that, because I've written a couple of small blog pieces on that, and I think California just enacted their IoT law, I think, in January.
Uh-huh.
But it's a very vague law, and I think they received a lot of criticism. That's the first, I think, true law here in the United States. Anyway, let's segue over to the overall cybersecurity landscape in general. One of the other hot button topic issues is the C-suite making them more accountable. You know, if like company XYZ is breached, well, the CISO should be fired. Now, I don't know if the CISO should get all the blame. I think all the employees are responsible. Just what are your thoughts on that?
So I think that personal responsibility is good for some things. It may make CISOs more strict on how they look at things. You know, the problem is if you're the CISO of a 100-user network, you have a much easier time controlling the aspects of security within your network, right? Then if you're the CISO of, say, I don't know, we'll use airlines, American or Delta, or somebody who has global operations, and a lot of those operations are vendors and service providers, it's much more difficult to have overall insight into your network. So we have to rely on people under us to do that. I think the personal responsibility of that is it will drive a CISO to creatively explore how they're going to handle and manage this vast, widespread network. But at the same time, I don't know if we can just point the finger and say, you know, you did this. I mean, I really think that airlines are a great example, because let's say you and I start ABC Airline and we have, you know, we fly to 2,000 cities around the world, and we have some of those, and we're all connected to the SABA system, which is the airline reservation system, and we still have to talk to, and we have people on our lands and our WANs that are in all types of countries, and some of those people are, you know, vendors. We might fly to, I don't know, St. Martin. And in St. Martin, our staff are really not ABC Airline employees. They're contractors from a provider that does this, right? So I think that we really have to look at when and how a breach occurs. We can't just turn around and say, oh, fire the CISO and bring somebody else in. To me, that's scapegoating. That's not really solving the problem. What we should be doing is working with organizations and with CISOs to provide guidance and governance. I'm not a big, you know, more government guy at all, but I think that when we put cybersecurity rules in place, the people that are going to regulate those rules and those requirements should be people who know how to do that, not people that go to a two-week training course. And I find that a big problem in the cybersecurity world. Regulators and people who are out there, there are some very, very good ones, and there's just some very, very bad ones. And there's so much going on that it's impossible to regulate everybody. So I think the personal responsibility law puts a little onus on a CISO to do a better job, but at the same time, it's not a cure-all. I think we need to really start looking at all different types of things. And unfortunately, our lawmakers jump on the bus. I think a good example of that is, you know, the congresswoman who got shot in Texas. The next day, I was watching C-SPAN, and some governor actually his solution to the problem was that they were going to put bulletproof glass around Congress. I mean, you know, or they're going to ban a specific model of handgun. And that happens in the cybersecurity world. Something happens, you know, the big data breach at Equifax. I mean,
right.
Some of the legislation some of the legislation around that was proposed is just absolutely ridiculous. It's again, that could have been, you know, we talked earlier about vulnerability assessments and penetration tests, right? Equifax had regular penetration tests. They had an outdated server running. That should have been found during a vulnerability assessment. But going back to the CISO in that case, should that CISO have been fired? I think that probably. Something like that is really a blatant oversight, because nobody was managing or handling the the security evaluations in the right way. And you know, I think that these guys now, they in reality, we should be sitting down and putting together a set of cybersecurity standards that make sense. I think NIST did a really good job, but they're trying to design a standard that's all-encompassing that anybody can apply. And there's so many different types of networks and so many different types of organizations that there's no way that anything but a very broad and very generic regulation is going to cover everything. I think we need to really look at how we are going to write these legislations and these regulations. New York is a great example. The Department of Financial Services had their new regulations to govern personally identifiable information and how it's stored and what they need to protect. And they based it on the size of the organization and the revenue generated. And in New York, yes, there's many big banks and many big operations, and they're easy to spot and they're easy to find. But there's also thousands of small financial providers, things like check cashing stores and you know, used car loans and student loan places and Western Unions and all these places that gather personal information. And if they do less than, I forget what it is, $1 million a year or something like that in business, they're basically exempt. You know, they have a couple little things they have to do. They have to have a disaster recovery plan, and they have to have a basic test done. But the regulations for the larger organizations are so much more encompassing than these smaller organizations. And I fail to see why we do that when you can have the same amount of damage from either one. I mean, a check cashing store probably services, 100,000 people a year that are of lower income and more susceptible than say a bank that does private wealth management. Yet the bank that have private wealth management has to be secure, and the check cashing store that handles lower income people doesn't make any sense to me. I think that we need to start looking at regulations or really not even regulations, standards, as something that are going to be practical, rather than just a way to say, we need to generate regulatory dollars. We need to generate more fees or more funds. And I honestly feel like that's what's going on right now. And that's part of why holding people personally responsible, I think, is a very, very small and really not a great solution to anything.
Okay. Well, thanks for your insight on that. Now, given the breadth of your global digital forensics and its international presence, have you dealt with any nation-state threat actors like North Korea, China, or Russia, so forth?
All the time. Yeah, all the time. It's a huge. It is the wave of the future, right? I think that the APT was coined, the Advanced Persistent Threat, but I think that we see three major types of hackers, if you will. You have financially motivated, and some of them have a lot of money and they do a really good job as well, if not better than some nation states, smart guys, whether they're Eastern European or, South American or Asian, they have a, they're motivated by money to do this and they do a good job. The nation state actors are always very advanced. I mean, they're, and we do it in this country. I mean, we have a great, highly skilled, cyber force. So when you ask me if I dealt with them, I deal with them basically on a daily basis. Nation state actors, financially motivated actors, and then we have, everybody else. We have hacktivists. We have all types of different people out there that are doing this type of stuff. So, it's a problem.
Right. Now, how do you foresee the cyber threat landscape changing, evolving, and what do you think the biggest cyber threat's going to be for the rest of the year and perhaps even going into 2020?
Well, I think that attacks against users are going to continually be a problem. I don't think that's going to change. Trying to gain access to a network through users. So I think that's something that's been a problem and is going to remain a problem for a long time. I think that the threat landscape is going to evolve. You know, one of the big issues in to me, and this is a long-term prediction, is that you touched on AI, right? And you said it very well, that it's one of the big trends and one of the big discussions in cybersecurity. And I think the big problem is that we have a lot of vendors who jump on the bus and they say, I've created a tool that stops all zero-day threats. I mean, I read it every day. And our buying into the marketing hype is a big problem. I don't believe there's any one solution out there or any group of solutions that is going to block 100% of the threats that are out there today. And that includes whether they're threats against users or network threats. I think that the trend really has to be that we work on better security in IoT. We work on letting vendors know that we don't believe them. I don't know how else to put it. That we question what they tell us rather than believe all the hype. And we start to realize that we have to go back to basics. There are just certain things that need to be done. And I think people are doing that. I'm seeing more and more talk everywhere. Yes, we're talking about artificial intelligence and all this advanced threat protection, but I see a trend going back to we need to test our security all the time. We need to make sure our users have strong passwords. We need to make sure that we don't have outdated equipment and outdated software. And I believe that's a good thing, because all of the new technology and all of the AI in the world can't protect us if we don't have the basics in place. And I'm seeing that trend happening, and I like it.
Okay, excellent. Now, our final question here as we wrap up our show, it's probably the $60,000 question. What do you recommend people and businesses to protect themselves from cyber threats, cyber attack? Is there a laundry list of items that you have, or a top three or four things you don't really tell people? I'm sure you get asked that quite a bit by your clients.
Well, I think awareness is a big one. That's my number one thing. We as users in general have to be aware. We have to be aware that we're going to receive emails and we're going to receive numerous attempts to compromise us and our devices. So I think cyber security awareness is very, very important. You know, I see many times, I do a lot of, you know, free training for seniors and students as a you know, pro bono type of stuff, and that training really centers around you know, the basics. Microsoft is not going to call you and ask you for your password. So I think user awareness is really number one on my list. And we need to, you know, just like we have, I believe that just like we have public service announcements that say, you know, don't smoke or you're going to get cancer, or don't drink and drive, we should have some public service announcements that raise awareness to people about what they should and shouldn't do and what they should be aware of. That will not only protect users at home, but it will help organizations, you know, protect themselves, because users just need awareness. So I think that's number one. Number two is get back to basics. You know, just make sure that you have a good, you know, patch management practice in place, and that you're patching and you're doing everything you need to do on the network. Your software's up to date, your hardware's up to date, everything is correct like that, and that your user policies are up to date and you're acquiring strong passwords. So getting back to the basics is, to me, is very, very important. And then third is, you know, when you start to implement security tools and software and hardware, that you question vendors and you technically, the people responsible for making the decisions are cybersecurity centric people and not purchasing. We shouldn't base what we buy on ads. We shouldn't base what we buy on cost. We should base what we buy on how well it fits into our network and how well it's going to perform and protect us. So So those are my three top things.
Okay. Well, Joe, we thank you very much for your time this afternoon, this week, and we really enjoyed it. I think you gave us a lot of good, you know, useful tips and some really great insight. We hope to have you again on some future podcasts.
Sure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care. Bye.